Right, we are recording.
Well, let's have the date, which is November the 5th. Oh, 5th. Maybe we'll be interrupted.
2018. Not at this time of the afternoon, which is about...
You'd think, but yes. People are very stupid.
Yes.
I wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, apologies in advance if it happens.
I'm Patrick Crozier. You are Brian Micklethwaite. And we're in your front room. Yes, it's 2018. Did we say that?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. And we're going to talk about transport.
Yeah.
Aren't we? Because we're both interested in transport.
I think it's a fascinating subject. I never lose interest. Even little tiny details like the fact that electronic signs have got better at stations and things like that. And bus stops. I particularly relish the bus stops telling you that there's a chance that there'll be the bus you want coming within the next day, which you didn't previously know.
Yeah, but don't you prefer all the big stuff? I mean, the idea new revolutionary technology.
Well, yes, jumbo jets and space rockets. Yeah, but what I'm saying is I love all of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the big stuff and the small stuff. I always have. I'm a small boy in that respect, and I always have been. I love the fact that Crossrail is crashing its way through the middle of London and will soon be open.
Aren't we supposed to be against that?
Well, of course we are, yes, but you know.
Yeah, it's still magnificent, isn't it?
If you're going to, that's the way to waste public money, as somebody once said of a battleship, I think. It's a wonderful subject. You're the expert on the subject because...
Well, what I'm an expert on is trains. And this goes back to... the sort of British rail privatisation crisis of about 2000. I think it was that year in which the railway network more or less came to a halt due to various worries over concerns over safety. And my question was then, how do we get to this mess? Surely private enterprise is a jolly good thing. And, I had to... research, you eventually realise that actually it's nothing to do with privatisation. I mean, it just hasn't been privatised in the sense that the network is not able, or a company in the network is not able to do things it wants to do, or it would do in a free market.
I've come to a rather pessimistic for a libertarian anyway, view of transport, which is that it's impossibly political. It cannot not be political. Whatever the regime is, if trains are buggered up and commuters have their work deranged or holidays or whatever it is goes wrong, people just snarl at whatever politician
They certainly do when the politicians are in charge.
Yeah.
I think part of it is to
but
do
I don't
with...
think a politi- I don't think a prime minister would go on TV and say, look, they're private companies. it's nothing to do with us.
I thought there was a more...
The answer would come... There'd be a shout saying, well, bloody well make it to do with you.
I always thought... I sort of agree with the beginning of your statement is that it is impossibly political. But I think it's really to do with the nature of the state. I mean, often these roads and railways are built for the transportation of armies.
Hmm.
And that is a critical state enterprise.
Yes.
And another point is that to a large extent the road is the state. Or whoever controls the road is the state. And although I play, and I love playing around the idea that you can have privately owned roads, there isn't much to choose between someone who owns your road and the state. Because they can do all sorts of things to you.
Yeah, whether they own... You can imagine a regime of privatised roads, but if a war started, the government would just barge out and just say it's ours. They'd commandeer it, I think.
Well, certainly in the First World War, the first thing they did was they take over the railways. So in this country, which was where the railways were entirely privately owned. So, yes, that is certainly possible. I was thinking more to the point is that if you don't have access to the road outside your door, you're essentially a prisoner.
Mm.
You have got to make some accommodation with the owner of that road.
Yeah. And it's political when somebody imprisons you. It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got to be a lawful situation somehow. If you are in prison, then there's got to be a damn good reason. And if you are without a damn good reason, then that's politics. And that's the sense in which I mean it. And I mean, I also feel that the governing of cities is incurably political.
Yeah.
In the deeper sense. Maybe they wouldn't be charging taxes. It would just be lots of people paying rent. But I still think the big rentiers would gather together and make collective decisions about things like when to expand the sewage system or what to do about some obviously very...
So when you say rentier, the big rentiers, the big companies
that do the stuff for the city would be constantly on the phone to each other and in touch with each other. And how could that not be an official institutional setup? It's going to happen. And so therefore the real competition happens between cities rather than...
Which is a competition, but it's a less direct... Mm. I mean, let's face it. I mean, there are lots of cities in America which have tremendous autonomy.
Mm.
And you'd have thought by now that voters would have figured out that voting Democrat is not a good way to run a city. But there are cities that have had Democrat mayors for 50, 100 years. Mm. So, mm.
Well, that's perhaps worth mentioning that there are some American midterm elections which are more than usually fraught, I think we can say.
Yes.
Coming up. The final
tomorrow, isn't it?
Tomorrow's the voting day, and tomorrow night that's when it all gets counted. Exactly when that is here, I don't know, but it's around tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's try to avoid that subject. We could.
Yeah, no, I agree. But what I'm getting at is the idea of cities being... And it could well be that somebody, a libertarian listening to me say that, would say, hang on, Brian, stop being a libertarian. To which I would reply, well, maybe. If that's how you define a libertarian, somebody who doesn't think what I've just said, well...
Well, I remember you writing a pamphlet, one of your last, which was, you said, look, when it comes to a choice between libertarianism and civilization, I'm for civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. And I think that's part of the reason why I wriggled out of any further official position in the libertarian movement, because I could feel myself starting to become politically something else.
Well, a little bit.
It's not that I'm against libertarianism. It's that it's when the questions being asked don't seem to be quite as much to do with libertarianism as they used to be. I mean, the whole point of...
And the questions are asked politically.
Mm. And the questions about transport. I mean, take, for example, the building of Crossrail. I'm not prepared to say that that's an inherently bad thing just because they stole lots of land to build the thing, which they did. I'm not convinced that's a sufficient argument against it. Now, it may well, I don't know the details of whether I... if I was seriously thinking about it, as opposed to train-spotting it, you know. I don't know what I'd think, but I don't regard compulsory purchase orders as an automatic proof that it's wicked. And I think that kind of argument is going to recur in future transport arguments, future transport dilemmas.
So I kind of do. I know it's sort of one of those esoteric libertarian issues, but I'm kind of against it, and I think it would be nice to think that you can build things without...
Mm. Oh, I couldn't agree more.
And I think there are ways of doing it.
Anyway, can we descend from the clouds and discuss the matter of train privatisation? You've talked to me about this before, and as I understand it, your big complaint is the separation of the running of the services and the ownership and maintenance of the track. Have I got that right?
Exactly that. This was part of the rail privatisation. Beforehand it hadn't happened. Well, it had happened once in about 1825 on the Stockton to Darlington Railway. They tried to separate these two things. They realised it didn't work. And very soon the two parts were combined in one operation, in one organisation. In Japan, they privatised their railways. Some railways have always been private, but they privatised the main nationalised railway in 1987. There was no question there of having a wheel rail split.
Well, when the great companies marched into, you know, the Great Western, the LMS, LNER, all these things, it never occurred to them to separate.
These
things.
I mean, there would have been a few things around the edges. I mean, for instance, for some times, there will be occasions when LNER locomotives need to use LMS tracks.
Well, the Royal Train, I can't help thinking, is owned by the monarch rather than by the railway system.
There may have been a variety of royal trains, depending on the network you were on.
Oh, really? So owned by each of the great companies?
I think there may have been,
How interesting. Yes. But who was responsible for this insane split?
Well, I could name names. Somewhere close to the Adam Smith Institute, yes. I think we have to look at them. And it's very frustrating because they still bang on about this every so often. You know, they'll say, oh, we should have a wheel rail split, so therefore we can have competition on the railways. And I think this is something that you and I both agree on, is that that's not the important thing. The important thing is not competition between different sorts of rail services. It's the idea that everything competes with everything else. Is rail is competing with road and walking and staying at home.
Yes, yes.
Or moving where you live to near your job, or job to near where you live.
It reminds me of Coase's theory of the firm, which is that firms exist for a reason. That you and big ones exist for a reason.
Yes, and it's to remove transaction costs, if I'm
not
correctly.
Yes, and there are transaction costs that get way out of control if you have an anarchy trying to run a railway system.
Yes, this brings us back to the early days of Transport Blog. For me, it does.
Which, by the way, came up is back on the internet after a brief pause. If anyone has tried to get there in the last few weeks, they will have failed. But apparently it's back, yes?
Last time I looked, but it's...
Nobody's writing for it, but it's there.
No, indeed. Yes. It still needs me to... Anyway, there's some work to be done on it anyway.
Anyway, the Adam Smith Institute, good, let's put the knife into them for this.
reluctantly.
My favourite example of proving that privatisations are not always right is if you favour privatisation under all circumstances, then you must be in favour of selling off the signals for scrap. Are you?
Or selling them off, at least.
Them off. Yes. I mean, and I mean railway stations on the same line competing with each other. You know, it's a reductio ad absurdum to establish the principle that there is a case for...
Well, the point is, actually, if you had privatised it that way, if you sold all the signals to one company, all the stations to another, all the trains to another, etc., etc., and just left it to the free market, they would have sorted it out.
Yes, they'd have amalgamated intelligently.
Yes.
In the previous answers you've given me to this question about whose bloody fault is this, you've said the EU. Fair dues, you also said the EU was responsible for freeing up the air travel market in Europe, and indeed beyond Europe, you said, which I didn't know. That was news to me. So EU isn't a complete idiot in these matters, but in matters of train privatisation, a complete idiot is what it's been, right?
Yes.
Because they've insisted on...
And the problem is, it's the impact of that is... Yeah, I mean, they demand that the whoever runs the separate accounting, as I think is the expression, for whoever the infrastructure and the train operators, which in theory could be done with the same company or two subsidiaries of the same company.
But that defeats the whole idea, doesn't
anyway. It? But yes, it's even happened in France, for instance. But there's SNCF, but SNCF has been divided into one part is SNCF, the other part is RFF, which is the infrastructure people.
It's a bit of a digression.
The point is, we took it a bit more seriously. And I think the other thing is that there are special factors to do with London.
Yeah.
I say that immediately, I think of Paris, which is of a city of a very similar size, which doesn't seem to have these problems. But I think that was the...
By the way, I recently had the, for me, novel experience of purchasing a railway ticket in France with some friends of mine. I didn't know how to do it, but they did. And it's an interesting... comparison. It reminded me of the British NHS.
Oh, there's some waiting is involved.
Lots of waiting. And above all, you absolutely couldn't lose your rag with these people. Otherwise, you just wouldn't be... You'd probably be forbidden to buy a railway ticket for the next year or something. That was the feeling you got. I'm not saying that was the rule.
But, this is the thing...
But the physical circumstances were luxurious. And you were there to beg them for service.
Yes.
Beg them for what they were selling. And they were just taking their time. You know, they were sort of pondering the question of how to sell you a nice ticket from, you know, Nantes to Poitiers or whatever the hell it was. And they didn't give a fuck about the fact that there was this enormous queue waiting for a train which they might very well miss.
Yes.
The reason they didn't realise how hated they surely were was that they were never told to their faces. Because if you told them to their faces, they had godlike powers to ruin your life. as does the NHS. And it was a remarkable comparison. By comparison, British ticket sellers really get on with it. You know, there's real sense of, there are other people here besides you, come on, let's get this done.
Yeah.
About the way they sell tickets. I appreciated the
Not least because so many ticket offices have been closed in recent years, because, of course, we now have Oyster.
Well, yes, but it was a telling comparison. And the physical surroundings were lavish, like a lot of NHS facilities these days. Very resplendent and shiny with sort of vases. I mean, unthinkable in Victoria or somewhere like that, you know, my local big station. It was extraordinary.
I would certainly argue that despite all the constraints over privatisation, there have been massive improvements. Trains are a lot cleaner, a lot less graffiti, a lot better maintained. The lights are always working, the seats are better.
Well, the trains themselves have just been replaced with better trains, haven't they?
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, in many
cases. I love modern trains. I hated the old ones. They had doors that were like the doors of safes, you know. Clunk.
Well,
they were absurd.
I thought the ride you'd get on the old trains was actually better. And also, because the seats were properly padded, it was a lot more comfortable. I really resent the modern seats, which are with the backs are very straight, and it's almost impossible to be comfortable sat without slouching. Which I think
I think they carry many more passengers now than they did, don't they?
They do, yes.
And I get that.
Well, to the best of our knowledge, it probably is. The numbers went up dramatically after privatisation, but as one rail manager I knew said, well, the difference is we're collecting the fare these days. You know, for a long time, you could avoid paying the fare if you wanted to. And nowadays, they're much more alive to it. And so they collect more money, more revenue. So it looks like there's more passengers. It may be the same number. But I'm pretty sure they have, actually.
I think there are more. And also, the carriages are designed to accommodate more standing people in rush hours, which is a compromise. And I get that my seat isn't very comfortable for that reason.
This is none of my bugbears. The extreme example, is Japan. This is the thing. You say, Japanese railways are wonderful. And then people immediately say, but what about all the people pushers? What about the overcrowding? Yeah, this is the one failure of the Japanese government, because Japanese fares, especially season tickets, are heavily regulated. The price is regulated downwards. And a classic example of supply and demand, if the price is artificially low, then you will have queues and shortages. In this case, it's overcrowding. More people want to get on trains than there's the space. And so you have this what seems to be an absurd situation where there are very, very few seats on a Japanese commuter train. And lots of standing. By the way, it has to be said that in some ways it's better, because you're much more comfortable standing in Japan, in Tokyo, than you are in this country, because everyone's standing, and so you're not sort of leaning over someone who's sat down.
Staring down their bra or something awkward. Yes.
Or spilling your coffee on them or something like that. Yeah. Yes. So that's better, but. And that's the private company's reaction to this regime. But you do wonder what would actually be, if a free market were, were involved, what would actually be the split between standing and seating? And we can go back. I mean, it was said in the 1890s that it was, I think the Metropolitan Railway had the view that it was the standers who paid the profits. So, in other words, you couldn't get it. You were always going to have some people standing. And people accept that. And for a short journey, I think people would accept that. It would be nice to know if you had a choice in these sorts of things.
So you'd get rid of the distinction between track and train?
Oh, absolutely, straight away.
And you're confident that, as you said, if you sold off all the bits separately, the bits would join up in a week or two.
Yes.
It would all be sorted.
Yeah.
And at that point, things like my sense that if I've been meaning to go to Birmingham to check out all the skyscrapers in Birmingham and also their new concert hall, which, well, it's not so new now, but I want to check it out. But I keep fearing that if I go to Birmingham, I will be charged £52 for a ticket that could have cost me £16 if I'd been cleverer. Yes. And that I really hate. I really, really hate.
That is interesting.
That feeling that I have to be clever to buy a cheap ticket. Whereas, I mean, this is why department stores were invented, to stop this crap. So you'd go into Selfridges in 1900 and you'd say, I want to buy this. And they'd say, it costs this much. And it costs that much to everybody who wants to buy that, no matter how much they try to have. And you start saying, well, I'll give you tenner for it. They say, no, sorry, it costs £15. If you want to have it, you will pay £15. No bullshit. And this was immensely attractive to lots of people.
Wow. Wow.
And I get that feeling about train tickets now. And I think a lot of other people do.
The thing is, I'm the other way. I love the fact that you can shop around.
Oh.
And I love going on websites.
Yeah.
I mean, on one occasion, I managed to get Virgin Rail to pay me for travelling on their trains. Because it was a £19 fare. And I got £20 compensation.
Whereas what I do when I travel on a train, I look at some other bloke and I think, that fucker's being paid to be on this train and I paid 25 quid or something.
I mean, it is interesting, though, that having travelled on in Japan, there is no question. There is none of this shopping around business.
Mm.
It's, the fare is
May I respectfully suggest this is why their trains are so very crowded, because that particular minority enthusiasm is something they're not subjected to.
Well, this is the ones I'm thinking about are the bullet trains, and they are most definitely not crowded, or not in my experience crowded, full enough. Mm. You go into. I mean, I'm travelling on bullet trains. I've got a.
Do they make money, the bullet trains?
Yes and no. They make money for the companies who operate them, JR East, JR Central, these sorts of people. However, they have, up to now, always required the government to build the tracks in the first place.
Mm.
But, and this is a really big but, and I'm glad you mentioned it, JR Central is, as we speak, building the world's first long-distance magnetic levitation route from Tokyo, initially to Nagoya and eventually to Osaka. This is mainly going through mountainous areas in Japan.
And physically, what is a maglev? Is it a kind of vertical plank going up and down across, on top of which perches the train? Or is it some sort of scooped out track or something?
It usually looks, in profile, sort of like a dish almost. Well, it's a dish with perpendicular sides.
Right.
I'm trying to indicate to Brian how it looks. And
yes, there are times when we need television.
Yes.
But or video, as I believe.
And it's essentially it's a trough.
Yes.
In which the train travels.
And does it travel a lot on stilts? And,
it will travel on viaducts and tunnels.
A lot.
For the vast majority of the journey.
Japan being Japan.
Yeah.
And is there a possibility that if this works, that standard, that once the Japanese have worked out how you do this, that it will spread in the same sort of way that railways spread in the 19th century?
I'm not optimistic on that front because of what happened with their bullet trains. Is they were the first people to come up with these 125 mile an hour trains. They did it in 1964. And you'd have thought everyone else bought the technology.
Hmm.
Well, no, they didn't. The next one that came along actually was the British, who were using existing tracks with the high-speed train, which was a diesel. Then it was the French with their TGVs, which was a very different technology. There's some ways it's better, some ways it worse. But the point was the French said, no, we're not having Japanese stuff. We'll do it ourselves, thank you very much.
Hmm.
That was their attitude. And ever since then, the French have been able to sell their technology fairly easily. I think the Germans have a slightly different.
Why is the French stuff more popular than the Japanese?
Probably because there are more high-speed lines in Europe. Also because the Chinese utterly refuse to buy anything Japanese under any circumstances.
Oh, and so they'll buy.
So the Japanese
French
are left,
or anything.
They can sell things to the Taiwanese, and that's it.
Mm.
But there's also another point is the way, if you think about a map of Japan, Japan is a long, thin country.
Yeah.
It has in some enormous cities in, I mean, Tokyo is 40 million, and Osaka and Nagoya, and they're all in a line.
Mm.
So that makes a high-speed rail. Even under those circumstances, it doesn't make a high-speed line profitable, although JR Central may prove us wrong on this. But it means that it makes some sense.
It's logical. It's logical. The bigger picture makes sense in terms of the impact on the country as a whole.
Although, as a point you made in the early days of Transport Blog, how come there isn't a line in the northeast of the United States from Washington, New York, Boston, places like Philadelphia?
Mm.
Who knows? Is the answer to that?
Yes, that's odd, isn't it?
Not quite good. Anyway, I was just going to say one more thing about this this maglev. It is incredibly fast. It is JR Central.
Well, can we just have some numbers for that? What's the high speed train, and how does the maglev compare with it?
If I remember correctly, high speed trains tend to be top off about 300 kilometres an hour, which is about 186 miles an hour.
It helps that I actually don't know these things. Say that one again.
186 miles.
That's
an
the
hour.
Fast train. And the maglev is what?
I think it may be 500 kilometres an hour.
That's 300 mph or something, is it?
Something like that, yes.
Wow.
It is.
I've been swearing too much already, but I'm tempted to do it again. That's amazing.
We must check on this one, because...
That starts to compete with aeroplanes, doesn't it? Seriously.
Well, of course, one of the impacts of the bullet trains originally was to destroy the part of the domestic airline industry. Mm. If you're travelling from Tokyo to Osaka, you take a train. Mm. If you're travelling from Tokyo to Hiroshima, you may well, or Fukuyama, which is a bit further
on. Sort of London to Edinburgh territory.
Yes. How does Tokyo-Osaka compare
well,
to...
Well, it's the time... Yeah. I mean,
it's about... The magic number is 3 hours.
If you take a train trip that basically ruins your day, then it's not helpful.
Yeah.
You want the point of a train. The point of speed is to enable you to travel and get something done on the same day, and maybe even get home again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there is a point where actually all the hassle of getting to an airport and going through security and all the queues and all the nonsense actually makes some sense.
Well, one of the things I most like doing is reading a book on a train, and because I have a million books, as you know, you can see them, you're staring at them past my head. I'm very bad at reading books at home because of the internet getting in the way. So I take a really good book with me on a train, and I love it. And I don't care if it takes an extra 2 hours compared to an aeroplane. Mm. And I really love that you arrive at an intelligent place at the end, as opposed to an airport, which is insane.
Whereas if you took the coach, you would probably get motion sickness trying to read.
No.
Well, I certainly would.
Yeah.
Which
brings us to the matter of road transport, which I think we should now switch to, shall we?
We have been promising
have we,
this.
Have we, promised covered, ourselves have we covered trains? Are there any more train things you want to say?
Only that JR Central have bet the farm on this maglev.
If
they succeed, I think one of the greatest achievements we have ever seen.
That's interesting.
I think it's the greatest infrastructure project going on anywhere in the world at the moment. Mm. And
I mean, the British versions, HS2 and Crossrail, are just dotting the I's and crossing the T's, aren't they, by comparison? Adding to the already rather antiquated system with another slightly antiquated pair of additions.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, their clocks were totally cleaned by what we're going to talk about, robot cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do we make of robot cars? You were saying Google have got some...
In principle, the idea that you don't have to have a driver in your car and you don't have to be sober and you don't have to pass all these rules, you don't have to follow all these rules and regulations, sounds wonderful.
Mm.
And I have been really looking forward to this happening for a long time. I think when we first started talking about this conversation, I was beginning to have my doubts because it's been 9 years since Google started there.
I am absolutely baffled by robot cars in the following sense, that it seems to me if you want to pick a complicated environment to test out, to prove whether a robot car can do anything useful, the absolute last place on God's earth is a major city with a taxi or something like that. The logical place would be some kind of dedicated track. The most obvious would be a railway. So you do have robot trains. Sorry, we're back to trains. But on the Docklands Light Railway in London, those are the only robotized trains we have in London, despite the fact that they could perfectly easily have robot trains on the tube in other settings were it not for
isn't that interesting?
Because, union opposition.
My understanding is the Victoria line, you don't need the drivers at all.
Mm.
But there they are. But the other thing is, well, you look at Japan, and you know, Japan, I'm pretty sure, is not highly unionized. But yet, every train has a driver, and it's a proper driver. I mean, it's not...
Something to do with the fact that every once in a blue moon, something happens that a robot just cannot make any sense of, I guess.
Maybe.
Which leads me on to the next question. How the hell do they think robot cars are going to be able to weave their way through Oxford Street? It just seems to me demented. And yet, I get emails about robot cars from Google, appropriately enough, and there are lots of companies all apparently trying to make it work. And they're all talking about the same things, taxis and little tiny cars, rather than lorries on motorways, which seems to me the next best thing in terms of controlled environment.
And yet they've been testing these things for what is it now?
Without much in the way of slaughter.
10 years. Yes, I mean, it's fascinating to look at the crash statistics. There have been 12 collisions involving these robot cars.
Mm. But that doesn't mean they caused them. I mean, just some...
No, indeed.
I mean, you know, if you are trying to ambush a robot car, chances are you could make it work. And 12, that's nothing.
Well, more to the point, it is always not the software that's doing it. I mean, sometimes it's the Google car is driven manually.
Into a tree.
Into a tree or something.
Yes.
That's from Google. I mean, I think Uber did have an incident at the beginning of the year where it's sort of about 50-50. There's a fatality involved.
Well, I would expect the software to get baffled constantly, but apparently it doesn't seem to be. Yes.
But then again, there's this whole delay. I mean, this has been true, I'm sure, for about 4 or 5 years.
Well, I read an article which made me LOL, which was... Apparently, one of the systems is really good, apart from the fact that it's having trouble working out whether objects in its vicinity are moving or stationary. And I remember thinking, that sounds a bit basic. You know, if you can't get that one right, you're not really...
Well, you sort of wonder about the rumour mill, don't you? I mean, Google are very tight-lipped about this whole project.
But they're going to get it done by the end of this year, are they? They're going to have...
Well, according to Wikipedia, yes, I did some research for this, and according to Wikipedia, they are going to have some sort of service, probably in Phoenix, Arizona, as a bit of Phoenix, Yorkshire, sometime by the end of this year, and it's November 5th, as we mentioned earlier, so they haven't got very long to start this. Wow.
I'll believe it when I read about it and see it on boring things like the BBC News.
Yes.
And until then, I'm going to assume that this is all a great big flim-flam about very little.
I mean, you think it might be something like the, not the HST, the APT. Do you remember the Advanced Passenger Train in this country?
Vaguely. That was the one that they couldn't sort out the tilting, wasn't it? Was that?
It did tilt. That was the point.
They couldn't make it work.
It was incredibly advanced technology.
And it collided with itself on the opposite track.
And
or something.
Yes. There are big problems about that.
But that's the one.
But the point is, they did, roll it out. They had fare-paying passengers on this service, and then it all went wrong. I mean, maybe, of course, in a sense, it didn't, because at least the ideas have been picked up elsewhere. And you get tilting trains in the weirdest places these days. So conceptually,
but wasn't the problem that two trains going past each other, one of them tilting absolutely correctly, and the other one tilting in the completely the wrong direction?
Well, that would be cause you that would
catastrophe
cause you a big problem,
and or an enormous bill to separate the lines on curves, and neither was satisfactory.
There was another problem.
And they never
the
really...
Tilting was slightly too good.
Yeah.
And so, as a passenger, you would feel that you're completely level, even though you go around a corner.
You can see that we're
fascinated
by... But
then you look out the window...
Yes.
And but the horizon was moving up and down. Mm. And apparently, this is the motion sickness again.
Oh, right.
This was... Yeah.
We're back to trains. But the point is, the APT, was this a driven by robots?
It wasn't driven by robots. The point is, it's a project. People have put a huge investment over a huge... many, many years. I mean, this took 10 years of development. And it gets rolled out and then it fails.
Mm. Mm.
So who knows? Maybe Google, self-driving cars are on for that. Ought to know quite
soon. You know
soon.
What it reminds me of? And that was the early days of websites, when every single paper-based publication on the planet said, oh yes, we have a website and we're very excited about it and it's just ready to go and it's nearly profitable and soon it will be. And it never was. A few people mastered a completely distinct and separate business with a completely new way of doing things. But most people, it was random. You know, it would be a huge coincidence if an organisation that had thrived with paper and ink also thrived on the internet.
Well, can we think of any organisations that managed the transition from non-internet business to an internet business?
The other thing was that although... the newspaper business could see the end of... They could see the writing on the wall for themselves, quite rightly, and it was clearly there. The scale of their turnover was colossal still. And they could finance a sort of pretend website enterprise. They could have a room full of geeks playing with a website. On the basis of, 2 hours of income, they could spend that much in a year on the website and the geeks could lose the whole lot. It wouldn't matter. Yes. Hardly showed up on the bounce sheet. And then suddenly it did. When they started losing serious money with their printing, the accountants would come in and say, right, we've got to have a clean-up of all the loss-making enterprises. Who are these idiots playing with a website? Are they making any money? No, they're not. Fire the lot of them. And I have that feeling about robot cars with the big car companies.
Yeah.
That this is big money... A tiny slice of big money is being thrown at robot cars so that they can all say, yes, we're doing robot cars.
Sorry, Brian, I'm not quite with you. I mean, it's so true. My understanding is that Ford have a self-driving program. GM have self-driving.
Yeah, they all have.
But the people who are doing the leading on this seem to me to be Google and Uber, although Google accused Uber of stealing their technology. So maybe it's only Google. But it strikes me that is...
It's a similar example to what you're saying. Companies. It's Silicon Valley leading with this rather than...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I mean, of course, with the internet, you didn't need anything to do with newspapers to do your own... Well, as we were, as bloggers, we didn't need to have any connection with them.
Mm.
But, you're still going to need, as far as we know, tyres and wheels and suspension and some way of moving the thing around.
So, in other words, the big car companies are more like suppliers for this industry than they are active participants.
I have heard it said it's the other way around. Yeah. Ultimately, Google or Waymo, as they now call themselves, are going to be suppliers to the car companies.
Yeah. Well, clearly there's a distinct industry in the offing. But it must be very difficult to operate in it because you just don't really know what's going to happen. One thing I think you can state with confidence is that if and when this stuff really starts happening, if they amaze me by starting to have taxis prowling around London without mishap in 3 or 4 years' time, which is what we're told is going to happen, which would amaze me, but if it happened, then there will come a moment when surely robot cars will have their own dedicated roads for one very simple reason, which is that they can now travel much faster than regular cars are allowed to.
Yeah.
We've discovered that if you forbid humans to drive cars faster than 70, you reduce the carnage. Well, robot cars, I mean, this is something they know how to do, drive really fast without making stupid mistakes of a very repetitive kind. I mean, what humans find it hard to do is to go on doing the same right thing all the time, hour after hour. Robots, absolutely built for that.
Yeah, I think we were talking about this previously, weren't we? There ought to be sort of really high-speed lanes on motorways because it's a very controlled environment.
Well, surely there'll be high-speed lanes rather like those maglevs, you know, they'll be separate.
Yeah.
And that's when the age of robot cars really arrives, it seems to me.
That's odd. That's odd you say that. I must admit, I had always thought of robot cars in cities as being the huge advantage because you'll be able to get around much more easily. Again, the whole business about alcohol and safety, and you can forget about that. Also, things like parking. Now, my assumption has been for a long time, on what basis, who knows, that ownership of cars will decline. You will hire it for the journey you need to take.
Well, this is, if that's the case, then Uber are clearly well-placed, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point being is, all of a sudden, all those cars lining the roads, a lot of them will go. And I was thinking about this on the way up. A lot of the reason, well, why is it we own cars? It's probably actually due to safety, because it's a way of internalizing our incompetence. You know, because no one was, you know, renting. I mean, yeah, obviously, hire car businesses exist, but it's dangerous.
Oh, this is the PJ O'Rourke thing. What cars handle best? Hire cars.
Yes,
What can you? Yes, but when he says handle best, he means handle most dangerously and excitingly.
Yes.
He was 25 when he said this. Yes.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It certainly is the case. I am very fond of photographing London. And I'm also very fond of how my fellow digital photographers love to photograph some things but don't love to photograph others. I'm fascinated by the aesthetics of it. And one of the things I've taken more and more to photographing is lines of parked cars, because that defines our time so much, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
And more and more I'm...
I mean, yes, you look at old photographs... And there's no car, nothing. I mean, there isn't a horse and a cart, you know, stood by the side of the road ready to be...
Because people didn't own a horse and a cart, by and large, did they?
Or if they did, they kept the horse in the stables.
Yeah, so, well, they had to own a stately home to keep it going. But yes, I mean, when I started taking photos in about 2000, that's when all proper digital photography got started, I, like every other digital photographer, would make a point of trying to avoid certain things in my pictures, and one of them was lines of cars. More and more, I find myself thinking, no, whenever I want to avoid something, that means it's interesting. That means I should be photographing it. Things like multiple street signs, five poles next to each other, one of them with a sign, one of them with a spy camera, one of them with another sign saying something else, and one of them with a light on it, another one with a basket of flowers or something. That's interesting. It's something you should be photoing on purpose, because...
Well, there's a question.
I mean, what I feel about parked cars more and more.
Yeah.
I'm making a point of photographing them. I already photograph taxis because I just them.
But the thing is, surely one line of parked cars looks very similar to another line of parked cars. Can they be distinguished in any meaningful way?
Well, they can be included in pictures of other more photographically appealing things like Big Ben.
Right.
But it's a fact about... I mean, most photographers try to get rid of these things, with the result that our photographic record of the 20th century is going to be an enormous lie. It's going to consist of a million pictures of Big Ben and Westminster Abbey and Tower Bridge and the bloody cars that were everywhere. Well, actually... They'll be in the photos because we have photos of absolutely everything now. But
I think there are enough movies which have.
But you're right that parked cars are of a very interesting fact, and the fact that they're so lavishly designed. Will
again, this is to do with ownership, of course. That's a shame. That's presumably going to go.
Well, they're going to be just sort of brand X boxes on wheels.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, one suspects that's how it's going to be.
Well, I think we don't know is the short answer. We really don't know how this story is going to unfold. In many ways,
yes, I suppose I'd probably pay a little bit more for a slightly prettier car, because you want a pretty car
anything we would recognise as a car? That's the next question ask, isn't it? Will it perhaps be more like a A caravan.
Well, it's going to need seats. It's going to need a transmission. It's going to need a suspension. It's going to need storage space.
But all of these things, it's unclear.
Will it need windows?
You see, once a car starts travelling at 300 miles an hour, it then becomes a question, does the same vehicle that goes from London to Birmingham along a robot car, maglev, maybe on a maglev, you know, maybe you park it on something else, yes, and transport it like a container. Is that the same vehicle as the one you asked to come around and collect you at your front door?
Who knows? Well,
exactly.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know how, this may be just me, but I find the idea of getting out of a vehicle during a journey a real pain in the neck.
Yes.
What I want... Ah, good, you're the same as me.
Yeah.
Maybe
I hate changing on the underground.
Yes.
I walk quite large distances to avoid it.
And one of the businesses about air travel is you have to use one box to get there, another box when you've got there.
Yes.
And I...
And the question...
So the idea that you just get in one box, there's certainly an advantage to that.
Mm. But if it's very expensive to do that, then people
obviously
won't do it. They'll
listen
to the signal that the price is telling them, as we both know. Yeah. But it's unclear to me what these various trade-offs will consist of.
Mm. Well, I mean, can you imagine the sort of debates that people have been having in 1900 about what cars would be like and what very difficult.
Even how you...
transport. I mean, I came across this wonderful set of postcards from about 1911, Russian postcards, about what the future transport would look like. And it was all monorails.
Yes.
Monorails in the sky. That's what they thought was going to be the future. And, of course, almost nowhere has that sort of transport to this day.
Yes.
So...
Well, in many ways, the next era of robot cars, it reminds me of the era when they started putting steam engines on sailing ships. And for a sort of 20-year period, I believe, about that sort of length of time, you had these curious hybrid ships with enormous sails, you know, a dozen of them, stretching up into the sky to catch these huge South Sea winds, trade winds. But also a motor in case the wind let you down or you needed to get into port in the wrong direction or something. You know. And for a long time, that made sense. There must be lots of people wandering around in our world not knowing that this era even happened because it's so arcane and weird.
Yes.
And you can imagine something similar happening with robot cars that in 100 years' time people will say, well, first they did you know they used to drive around in these funny little boxes with all curved and coloured, and they would drive them themselves and they would have terrible crashes, but they loved them. In as we talk about horses, you know, and then the robot cars, and what we have now is what happened, forgetting that there was this peculiar hybrid era when the robot cars were kind of avoiding the regular cars and trying not to drive into them.
Yes.
And where the politicians will be dragged in to adjudicate the fight. I mean, there will surely be some people almost maliciously causing robot cars to crash, given the state of public morals at the moment. And what do you do
about it? There is a beginning of a lobby against robot cars.
It occurs to me when I was thinking about the idea of what a lorry driver is, it seemed to me, I wrote a piece for Samizdat a couple of years ago, I think it was, saying robot lorries make sense to me, whereas robot cars don't, because it's too complicated. Whereas a robot lorry is on a motorway, a highly controlled environment, it could work. But it occurs to me that one of the things a lorry driver does is look after his load and stop it being stolen, or at least report that it's being stolen, or make some attempt to stop it being stolen. Whereas one of the problems of robot vehicles will be that there'll be literally nobody, that's the plan anyway, looking after what are maybe very valuable cargoes.
Well, difficult for someone to steal something that's in motion, of course.
I can't help thinking there's a way to do that. I mean, you basically stop it. and then you bash away in.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I mention that is just to make the point, to reinforce the point, that we really don't know how this is going to play out. And anyone who says they're sure is just being stupid.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, I suppose one of the questions is why someone hasn't found a niche, either in a certain sort of business or a certain geographical location where robot cars or robot transport of some description would not work.
Well, there are already... it's worth thinking about where there are already successful robot vehicles in action. I believe that in the mining industry, there are now plenty of such devices trundling about.
I understand it's beginning to happen, yes. Fully automated mining is beginning to happen.
Yeah, including vehicles.
Which it strikes me as amazing, seeing as how... given how complicated mining is. But yes, obviously.
But at least you can control it. You can at least stop, you know, people on bicycles with baskets bulging out the back, you know, from wandering around in front of these things. At least you can control the variables they'll face.
I understand Amazon themselves have, in their warehouses, they have little robots to go around.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Things. Again, a highly controlled, totally owned environment where you can boss everything. And I can't help thinking that's actually how robot vehicles are going to take off. They're going to happen in highly controlled environments, which is why I suspect that the Chinese may start with this, because they're a despotism already. They already make up their minds about everything. And if you object, well, sorry, mate, off you go to jail, you know.
Yeah.
I
was just like going back to something I was saying the last podcast is, well, I said the Chinese hadn't invented anything. Of course, they haven't. Did invent printing and gunpowder and a few other things, but they haven't invented anything recently, which is why.
Well, I'm not saying they invented the robot car, but they may very well take it upon themselves to pioneer its large scale use, because they can.
Yeah.
And the rest of the countries of the world, you know, having their inhibitions about, you know, silly old human rights and whatnot, those are going to find very hard, maybe.
Well, I have tremendous confidence in the freer parts of the world being more prosperous than less free parts, and that's maybe it's misplaced, maybe I could be proved wrong, but I thought the Cold War was a pretty darn good test, and I think we can be fairly sure we'll do better.
I've made a crib sheet of things I might want to say. Let me see if I've oh yes, I would like to mention this as a thought. About 20 years ago, I wrote a thing about the private ownership of public space, basically selling the roads so that the roads would dominate. I wrote about private owned roads as basically, I said, they were a precondition for robot cars, and I was assuming that the road would be very smart and the cars would be relatively dumb. They would just be told where to go by the road, that the road would be like the surface of a CD, which would constantly be pumping information into the car. Go this way, go that way.
Like a train track. The train track's constantly saying the driver where to go.
Yes. And it would appear that I'm wrong about that. Although I think the question of just how smart the system as a whole is going to be with robot cars is up in the air. It's clear that the robot cars themselves are going to contribute quite a bit of decision-making to the thing. But I made a little kind of frivolous prophecy, which is that Ferraris might turn out to be rather appealing as robot cars because they have a much lower clearance off the ground.
Yes.
And therefore, you could build bridges and car parks where only Ferraris would be allowed to go because they would be low enough. And there's an additional reason. If I'm right that robot cars, when they really get into their stride, will start travelling at 200 miles an hour, unlike the cars we have now, well, again, Ferraris, you know, and it could be... You know, sillier things have happened in history, but in 200 years' time, people will look back on us, on our cars, say, these cars, i.e. regular cars, are preposterous objects. But hang on, this thing has a whiff of the future about it. This is what we have, you know.
Yeah.
These McLaren cars that are about 2 foot tall and travel at 250 miles an hour because that's what they'll have.
Well, fortunately, I'm sorry to ring your parade there, Brian. I mean, there are plenty of saloons that will do 150 miles an hour.
I know, but the point is that there is great advantage economically to having a very low clearance. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, a bridge is not just twice as expensive to go twice as high. It's two by two times expensive, isn't it?
Yes.
That's a lot of money.
Yes,
we're talking indeed. About.
Which, by the way, of course, is why our deep level tubes in London are so tiny.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Whereas the district line is like
a regular. And by the way, parts of the Northern line were tinier still when they were first opened.
And then they scraped them bigger.
Yeah, they scraped them bigger.
Did they?
Which must be a massive project. And they did it.
Yeah. So, it's noticeable that for those who don't live in London, it is weird how the different London tube trains are very different in character.
Yes.
The district line is just a regular railway line, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they have the same abundantly wide vehicles that regular trains have.
Well, they were built in a cheap way. You find a road, you dig up the road, you lay dig down line. Enough and lay the track, and then you cover it over. Cut and cover, as it is now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that I think robot cars could be like that. And there, you can, I mean, when you consider how much stuff there is underground in a place like London, the depth of the tunnel is a big deal, isn't it? Because the width of the tunnel is a big deal already. The size of
I
any
think
it's, kind
it, the real constraint becomes how you get people from an underground station to the surface.
Yeah, but the Crossrail, they must have had agonising discussions about how big it had to be, or how difficult it would be to get it through all the various other stuff there was there.
Not size, because it was always going to be.
Oh, I see. It was always
a mainline
regular train size
gauge.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's British gauge, which of course is smaller than everyone else's gauge. So that's another thing. Yes, the depth. My understanding is that there is an awful, as you say, there's an awful lot underneath London.
Yeah.
There isn't actually that much space to put it.
No. And the other big London infrastructure project that they're now working on is this huge new public toilet thing.
It's a sewer, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Huge sewer from quite near to where it starts being the estuary, sort of beyond Docklands, up to Battersea.
Yeah.
Huge operation.
Yeah. Which is odd, isn't it? That is probably as huge, as expensive as Crossrail. And are we going to talk about it?
No.
No.
There were a couple of rather charming diggers I came across on my travels when I went towards Battersea to find out what's going on there. There's a lot of grubbing going on.
Yeah.
And there were two diggers. One was called Ursula, and I've forgotten the name of the other one. It was a big sort of circle.
Oh, those sorts of things.
Yes.
With the teeth. On
the yes, end. That's right. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, the only reason I mentioned the idea that Ferraris might be the future of road transport, as opposed to, you know, Ford Anglias or whatever they call them nowadays, Nissan, you know, clunkers, is because my main opinion about robot cars is we just don't know. Nothing is certain. Not when they'll get it working, whether it will actually work once they think they've got it working, and then what it will lead to. I don't know whether you agree,
but that's
what I think.
It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wise words.